the residents of HRM have installed more solar thermal than the rest of Canada combined in the last year. We predict over the lifespan of these systems, 25 years, the homeowners that installed systems to date to be saving over $5.5 million in energy costs.
Hi, and welcome to Habitat. I'm your host, Erica Butler, here with you for the next hour of conversations about how we live in our environment. Today on Habitat, we hear from Julian Boyle of Halifax's Solar City program. Solar City celebrates its first year of operations this weekend with a solar fiesta at the Dartmouth Sportsplex. As you heard in the opening, 250 homeowners have installed solar hot water systems in HRM in the past year, all with the help of the city's Solar City program. Julian Boyle will tell us all about it in just a minute. At about half past the hour, we'll listen in on Transit Planning 101, a talk put on by It's More Than Buses and Fusion Halifax this week to look at what the next steps are for transit planning in Halifax. Now that Council has given Metro Transit the go-ahead to redesign the route system more efficiently, planner Sean Gillis explains how we will also need to pay attention to factors like walkability and land use planning if we want the new system to really succeed. And finally, to round off the hour, a second installment of Talk Energy, produced out of CHUO in Ottawa. So stay tuned to Habitat on CKDU 88.1 FM, habitatradio.ca, and RPN, the Rabble Podcast Network. Let's get to it. Let's talk about Solar City. Julian Boyle is the manager for Strategic Energy Policy and Initiatives with the Halifax Municipality. He's here with us today to talk about Solar City, the city project that helps bring solar hot water systems to homes in Halifax. Welcome to Habitat, Julian.
Well, thanks very much.
So how many homes in HRM now have solar hot water systems thanks to the Solar City program?
Well, we launched the program in about mid-March of last year, and I would say the first year was kind of still our ramp-up year. But in the first year, we're going to be over 250 homes that are due to have a system installed. We've had, right now, as of today, the end of February, I think we've roughly installed about 200 homes. So there's a bit of a backlog for the contractor, especially this time of year, to actually get out and install systems. But approximately 250 homes in our first year, which is fantastic because that basically is five times more solar than's ever been installed in a year in HRM, and in fact, the residents of HRM have installed more solar thermal than the rest of Canada combined in the last year. So it's been a really fantastic first year for the program.
Yeah, and when you say solar thermal, is that's the same as solar hot water?
Yeah, that's right. So this is some solar thermal systems can be used to actually heat your home, but this is geared just at the domestic hot water, so for showers and cooking and that kind of use, which is about 20-25% of a typical family's energy bill, actually. So it's won't get into too much of the technical nuance of it, but it's where there's a pretty decent economic return related to solar thermal. And plus, it allows us to really take a kind of a cookie-cutter approach to the program versus solar thermal systems designed to heat a home where it would be much more engineered, so to speak.
Much more customized to each home, you mean?
Exactly, that's right. So depending on the size of the home and the orientation and what type of heating system, in-floor, whatever they have. And so we really wanted to avoid kind of getting into too much non-standard kind of installations, which is really allows us to do a program at scale versus a custom installation for each home.
So do you have any idea how much energy those 250 systems will be saving in a year?
Well, they're going to save in 2013 energy costs over $100,000 a year. We predict over the lifespan of these systems, which mostly these systems last 25 to 35 years, but over the lifespan of 25 years, that the homeowners that installed systems to date to be saving over $5.5 million in energy costs. So it's a pretty good kind of kickback to the residents that have actually installed solar thermal so far, and we're still in kind of ramp up mode for the program, which is really exciting.
Yeah. Now, just for people who haven't heard of the program, this is not the city giving people solar hot water systems, right? You guys are actually sort of organizing it, brokering it, and financing it for people. But people have to, you know, people will be paying for these things.
Exactly. We provide an avenue for to finance the system, so people don't have to come up with the upfront money. But we really try and really make it easy for the homeowner. We also collect any rebates and incentives that homeowners can get from these systems. So typically, a homeowner's had to sort of be out on their own to navigate kind of the incentive programs out there. And so we've really streamlined that and made that easier for homeowners. So there is some definite financial benefit to participating in the program. There's also some real economies of scale, obviously, for delivering the program as well. So, but in the end of the day, exactly, the homeowner does have to pay for this. We offer financing up to 10 years at 3.5%. So we've actually do pass on our cost of financing. And it's fairly competitive. And the financing has been attractive to homeowners. About 90% of the people participating in the program do opt for the financing. Not everybody, but the majority of people. So that really takes away the kind of the pain of having to come up with $8,000 upfront for one of these systems.
So, and I guess the financing of it, or that was one of the reasons that you needed, you know, the SolarCity program to get started needed a chunk of money to begin with. Now, now that you have a chunk of money, will it just be perpetually self-funding?
Well, that's certainly the model that we started with, and certainly the first year sort of proven out that this is budget neutral for the municipality. Our councillors and mayor have been very supportive of the program. So we're in the first year of a two-year pilot for this, but I would suspect the track we're on right now is, we'll be back at council and have a decision really about sort of continuation of this program. It is kind of like this perpetual finance machine, so it can feed itself. So it's really interesting from a municipal perspective to be able to do that and to enable this, and not only enable it really for the benefit of residents too, but you know, this has been a significant boost to the solar community and solar industry in Halifax and Nova Scotia as well. So there's a whole bunch of reasons why it's actually, you know, the municipality is interested in kind of stimulating these kind of initiatives.
Who is the company, or is there more than one company? I don't even know how it's working, but who is doing the actual installations and manufacturing these panels and that sort of thing?
So the prime company is a Burnside called Thermodynamics, and they subcontracted the installations as well to some companies that might be known locally, like Dr. Solar and Scotia Renewables. Thermodynamics is primarily in the manufacturing. So these solar systems are actually made here in Nova Scotia in Burnside. So they've been in business for over 30 years. And in fact, they're the oldest solar thermal manufacturer in the world. And so that's what I've been told. And they've got a very good, high quality product. We've been extremely happy with the installation process and the delivery of this, and so it's great to have this capacity here kind of in our backyard, and we sort of can't sort of say enough about how well it's gone, for not only from the municipality's perspective, but I think from the residents as well.
Now, you mentioned the pilot is going for 2 years. I've also seen the target of 1,000 homes. So does that mean in this next year that's starting now that you guys are aiming for 750 more homes?
Yeah, there's some twigs to that from a financing perspective. I mean, what we're seeing generally is the systems are larger and more expensive than what we initially predicted, but also saving more energy. And in hindsight, I guess we could have maybe forecasted that a little bit better. I mean, you know, what tends to happen is people that aren't going to save as much as they think. They sort of self-select themselves out of the program. So I think right now, I think we've got financing, at least in the pilot phase, for about 600 to 700 homes. But if this program, at some point, if it does continue beyond the pilot phase, which that decision would be getting made sometime next year, it's you know, at some point, yeah, we'll hit 1,000 homes. So I suspect we're definitely going to do more in the second year than the first year. And certainly the contractors are really gearing up to ramp up significantly this spring when the weather sort of, when we thaw out our roofs to increase the number of installations this year. So we worked out a lot of things during the ramp up phase, which has, you know, really been quite satisfactory.
Now, you guys, this Saturday, you have a celebration of sorts, but also an information opportunity for people. What's going on this weekend?
So we got our first Solar Fiesta event this Saturday at the Dartmouth Sportsbox, and that's from 10:30 to 1. What it is, it's really just a sort of a celebration of the first year. We're going to have some food, some music, but we're also going to have some solar technology equipment and demonstration is a thing, so homeowners can come out and touch and sort of feel it and ask some questions. We're going to actually have a lot of the homeowners that have already had systems installed, they're coming out too, so people can talk to homeowners that actually have a system and, you know, hear directly from them about their experiences with the program and things like that. So it's really a kind of a 1 year anniversary. And we're also going to be opening up the registration early next week as well for the new batch of participants. So we'd encourage if anybody's really interested in solar and the Solar City program to certainly come out on Saturday and get in the Solar Fiesta mood.
Mm-hmm. When the program first launched, and I think this was actually even it would have been quite a few years ago because I think there was a false start with funding. When the program first launched and the call went out for people interested, it was overwhelming response that you guys got, was it not?
Well, before we had really designed the program, our council was really liked the idea of the concept. And they said, why don't you come and talk to the public and see if there's interest here? Because, you know, if there was only, 50 people that would be interested in this, well, we couldn't really spend the money to develop a program or the staff time and resources. So this was in 2010, and we went out to the public with kind of just an idea and say, what do you think about this, right? And we were quite frankly blown away. We just couldn't believe it. And we had over 1,000 people come out to 5 public sessions we had about the event. Council said, well, that's a very positive indicator. And then we had a pre-registration after that, and we had 800 people sign up on the first day. We actually had to close the registration after a month at about 1,500 homes. So that was 2.5 years ago. And then it took us a while to kind of piece together the financing and the details of the program and procurement and all that kind of stuff. And the public's been really patient with us, and it's been fantastic. You're right. I mean, certainly the level of kind of interest in the program was really exciting a couple of years ago, and that still seems to continue. And I think that's a real tribute to the community and kind of their interest to try and people are motivated to participate in this for a lot of reasons. One is obviously they want to try and save some money and see energy costs going nowhere but up. But also, there's a really good environmental impact here, too. So people are thinking of kind of a legacy. I got kids, and yeah, they use a lot of hot water, and I would like to leave the place a better place, right? And so there's all kinds of different reasons people are participating in the program, not just financially, which is really interesting, and it's not one that's right or wrong. And we really just sort of encourage people to sort of make up their own mind about why they'd want to have the system installed.
Where did the idea for the project first come from? Is it modeled after something somewhere else, or did it, you know, was it just one HRM staff member's idea at a staff meeting one day?
Well, we'd corporately begun installing quite a bit of solar in 2008, 9, and 10. You could see that like at Centennial Pool or the police station on Goderton and, oh, at least about a dozen fire stations. And so we'd sort of been kicking the tires on a lot of solar technology corporately. And back then, you know, there was a fair amount of federal and provincial incentives for solar thermal. You know, so much that you could get almost 60 or 70% of the system paid for. And so we were really scratching our head and said, you know, why isn't the public really know much about this? And, you know, there's obviously some barriers here. And at that time, we were really looking to kind of take some lessons learned from corporate stuff to really apply to a community scale project. So we had some starts and stops at some other kind of initiatives around district energy and what have you. So this kind of started to kind of move us in this direction. There was also, I mean, the program really takes, I would say, it's just together a lot of best practices from elsewhere and little bits and pieces of things. And there's certainly the financing mechanism. Was starting to get a lot of uptake in the U.S. through something called PACE programming. That's Property Assessed Clean Energy. It's the acronym what it stands for, but it's really kind of the backbone of the same financing tool that we use. So we had watched what was happening there. Quite frankly, we didn't realize we were going to be so cutting edge in Canada here, but we are the first jurisdiction to have the legislative authority to implement a PACE program, the first one to actually launch one. But in the last year and a half, there's been a real upswell in other municipalities across Canada about utilizing this financing tool. And Toronto just launched a $20 million program 4 or 5 months after we did. And I'm aware of like 55 municipalities in Ontario and Quebec alone that are also looking at kind of similar type of programs. And we have some closer to home here too that are really kicking the tires on it as well. So it's pretty exciting to kind of see that. And some pressure to make sure our program does well because, there's a lot of people are asking us a lot of questions about what's working, what's not working, what would you do differently and this and that. So it's pretty exciting. So we took lessons learned from a whole bunch of different places really. And they're really against the backdrop of our council and the mayor really sort of giving us a green light to kind of try and develop a program like Solar City.
Mm-hmm. Is it easy to explain how solar hot water works?
The simplest explanation I ever heard was this, is think about a black garden hose in your backyard, and when you turn it on, you get this really hot water comes out of it. That's in essence what these panels on a roof do, and so they heat up a fluid. That heat then is transferred to your solar storage tank. So if people would be familiar with tanks if they've got an electric hot water heater. So this would basically have a storage of that solar heat. And during the day that would accumulate and then you can use it anytime during the day. So these systems are designed to typically provide 70 to 80% of the energy to heat your domestic hot water. Not all of it. There's some reasons why you don't want to do all of it. But in essence, that's about as simple as I get. So you think about kind of it's a little more high tech than that, but that's basically the principle of how it works.
Right, right. Yeah. So you have an extra tank in your house that has sort of this preheated water or this solar heated water, and then that tank feeds in, and your regular hot water tank finishes off the job.
Correct. That's okay. Right. So there are certainly days here in Nova Scotia, and we've experienced over the last 2 months where it's not sunny and
no.
snowing or raining. So you do need to have kind of a source of heat for for your domestic hot water or for source of energy. And so this really does, it ties it in and integrates with your existing system. And that really, you know, doesn't matter whether it's electricity, oil, or propane. I mean, there's sort of some slightly different flavors of the tie-in, so to speak, that this works with all existing kind of systems.
How do we do for sunshine in HRM? I mean, are we well positioned? You mentioned that there is going to be a solar map released at the event on Saturday.
Yeah, that's another exciting thing people can come out and see on Saturday, and it'll be accessible on our website sometime in the next week as well. Nova Scotia and Halifax does have a pretty good solar regime. It's like in the top 10 or 15% in Canada. I think I heard it scored as the third best city, but I'm not sure about that. But I know we're up there. There's not much difference between ourselves and some places in the west, and Toronto as well. And so we actually get a fair amount of solar here. The other thing is, too, is people think of kind of particularly on Peninsula Halifax, oh, well, you know, we've got all these trees and, you know, we've got fog here or this or that. And so, and actually, when you get up on the roof line of most homes, there's actually a lot of solar energy available. So this solar energy map, which will allow basically people to kind of explore solar energy like a Google map, really shows kind of the energy potential on homes and roofs all across the municipality. And Dalhousie had taken 3D LiDAR data for us and put it through a program to simulate the track of the sun and shading and obstructions and all that kind of thing on the very fine resolution, and basically produced this kind of color map of the city for us. So it's a fantastic thing, so people can really see kind of how they compare to their neighbors or that might or might not already have solar system installed. And so it's really just a first step, but certainly that's one of the things is really kind of seeing is believing, and if you can see kind of a solar energy map of your neighborhood, it might get you thinking about kind of some of the alternatives you have.
Mm-hmm. Have you heard, you know, much ask out there in the public or in the people that are registering for the program about adopting different technologies with the same sort of idea of helping people, say, with photovoltaic or, you know, something that's actually generating electricity?
Absolutely. A lot of people are saying, this is great, but when are you going to add PV to the program? And and actually, at our Solar Fiesta, we've got some PV equipment and some mini workshops on that. We also kind of are a believer in solar hot air, too. It's not as well known as PV, but it's kind of a less costly solution. We picked solar thermal a couple of years ago because, quite frankly, the cost of PV was still too expensive there, but we see the cost coming down dramatically. So it's not to say that we would never include PV at all, and that might certainly be, one of the iterations of the program on a go-forward basis, but, you know, give people a couple of different options and solar thermal and solar PV and solar hot air, for that matter, they all complement each other. They don't kind of eat each other's lunch, as I describe it, from a savings point of view. We've actually just done our first PV projects corporately, too. So it's two projects on the commons there at the pavilion and also in the washroom and the North Common as well, those are both kind of residential size systems and really allowed us to sort of kick the tires and see what the real costs are in 2014 and what's involved in that technology. So I guess I'd just sort of say it's kind of wait and see. The program's just sort of cruising along really great with solar thermal right now. The economic returns for homeowners are averaging about 9% on their investment. So that's pretty good for solar thermal. Solar PV isn't quite there yet, so we'll just kind of have to take a wait and see approach to it and sort of see when a tipping point might happen.
All right. Well, thanks so much for your time today, Julian.
Well, if anybody has any questions, I certainly encourage them to visit our website. So if they go to halifax.ca/solarcity, there's lots of information there, and I sort of welcome anybody to come out to our solar fiesta on Saturday too, and really appreciate the call and the interview.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, bye. Julian. Bye-bye. That was Halifax's own Dog Day with Sunset from their album Fade Out. So this week, it's More Than Buses and Fusion Halifax hosted a talk called Transit Planning 101. It was a sort of primer for people interested in what goes into good transit design. Metro Transit is currently redesigning the route system for buses in Halifax, which is due to be implemented in 2016. And planner Sean Gillis sees lots of room for improvement. My takeaway from Gillis's talk was the idea that even good transit can't exist in a vacuum. In addition to a long list of improvements that Metro Transit can make to its system, there is plenty, Gillis points out that the wider design of the city is also a key factor in determining whether transit succeeds. He focused on walkability of neighborhoods, how routes need to be accessible on foot and also on the way to things that we want to go to. And these are the sorts of things that are out of the control of Metro Transit per se. They are affected by the combined work of multiple city and provincial departments and large independent players. I thought I'd bring you a bit of Sean Gillis's talk today. If you're interested in hearing more from him, look up his work on Spacing Atlantic or check him out on Twitter at Sean Plans.
So it's More Than Buses. We mobilize with the goal of getting to that point of a network redesign. And Metro Transit is going ahead with that idea, a new network. So it's probably fair to ask, How's the network performing now? What's the current system like? Just a question. Does anyone out there like the Metro Transit system? Okay. It's cool. There's some good things about it. Yeah.
A lot worse.
I've seen a lot worse. Yeah.
I like the ferry.
Ferry's fantastic. Okay. So we're not doing entirely poorly, are we? Is that fair to say?
Yeah. I feel like access is pretty good, but speed is.
Speed's pretty poor. Have you ever sat on the Route 1 on Bears Road for 20 minutes to go 4 feet? Is that fast or reliable?
No, not really. Waiting at West End Mall for a bus that doesn't come.
It's pretty unreliable.
They just call it a missed bus.
Your bus didn't
come. It disappeared somewhere.
Tough luck. So there's some problems, right? There's some problems. With all these problems, though, our current network, 1 in 8, about 12% HRM residents take the bus to work, bus or ferry. That is one of the best ridership rates for a medium-sized city in Canada. It's about 100,000 trips a day, or just a little over 20 million trips a year. So what's wrong? What's everyone so upset about? Well, one big thing, this is a pretty simple graphic. The cost to transport one rider has gone from $3 a couple of years ago to $4 today. So we're spending more money, and we're not getting very good returns. And there's just a general dissatisfaction with this network, with this bus service we have. 2010, 73%. That's not great, but it's doable. 2012, 60%. People are not happy with the service. And, I mean, when you look at this map, this is our current system map. Can you tell me where these routes go? If you're new to this city, if you've never ridden the bus, are you going to get on that and say, oh, I can easily get to Dartmouth? No. I can't make sense of this map. It's crazy. But just to give you an overview of the current system, we have 55 routes, just the regular everyday routes. We have 2 Metro X Commuter Express. They go to Tantallon. They also go to the airport.
Three?
Oh, it's started now, is it? Okay, great. We're going to Porter's Lake now. 3. Cool. 2 ferry routes, and we're going to have a new ferry in service pretty soon. 3 link routes and 3 community transit routes. And my friend Harry here, he's an international student from China, and when he's helping out with its more than buses, and he mentioned, you guys have 55 routes. I come from a city in China where we move 8 to 10 million people a day on transit. We don't have 55 routes. You guys have a lot of resources. It's really, really true. We have tons of resources. We'll get to it, but we're really making a mess. And then I also thought about the city that Harry comes from, and I thought, wow, in 3 days they move as many people as we do in a year. Mind-boggling what you can do with transit, how many people you can move. But 55 routes is a lot of resources, but way too many routes. So we're going to get to that in a second, though. But essentially, after this public consultation process, Metro Transit heard from the people. They told council, this network isn't working, let's blow it up. So we've got a complete redesign coming. So Metro Transit said, we're going to redesign the network, and we have these 4 principles, which are increase the proportion of resources dedicated to high ridership services, build a simplified transfer-based system, invest in service quality and reliability, and give transit increased priority in the transportation network. That's quite a mouthful. Busier routes, fewer routes, better service, and faster. That's what I hear going on there. And to me, that sounds a lot like what It's More Than Buses came up with in 2011. Fast, frequent, reliable, and user-friendly service. Frequency's not in there, but it's implied. When we redesign a network, one of the things we want to do is reuse resources very wisely. And again, who do you think I'm going to cite here?
Jet Walker,
thank you. Auckland, New Zealand. City of about 1.4 million people. A little bigger than Calgary. And this is the network in 2016, if this went along as usual, the frequent service network. Jarrett Walker went in and said, okay, let's do things some differently. He's worked with his transit agency. This is how much service they're going to provide on the frequent network. Here's the amazing thing. It costs the same amount to operate both systems. I didn't believe him when I first saw that. How is that possible? That's because there is so much waste in this system, so many duplicated routes running over each other, that they pull them apart and they put the buses elsewhere. So, zooming in on Halifax. The bridge, 580 buses per day. Most of them running in rush hour. Spring Garden, 725 buses a day. 1,000 plus buses on Barrington every day. It was 1,200 a couple of years ago. So that's enough buses to run, on average, in each direction, on the McDonald Bridge, a bus every 4 minutes, a bus every 3 minutes on Spring Garden, and a bus every 2.1 minutes on Barrington, from 6 a.m. until midnight. But you've seen what they do. There's 40 of them clumped through in rush hour, and then one doesn't come for 20 minutes. So being the enormous transit geek that I am, I went through the network and I kind of added up all of the waste, and the rough estimate is all of the waste, all of this duplication, we could run 82 kilometers of routes with 15-minute frequencies in both directions. That's the waste we're dealing with. So one of the things I chatted about with It's Born in Buses, they're like, oh, if we go into the suburbs, we're going to have to tell them they're losing all this service to make a great network on the core. No, we just take it all off of Barrington and put it somewhere useful. Literally. And Jarrett Walker, when he was here, he said, I bet there's enough service overlapping. They can just run frequent service on every major route in the peninsula. Yeah, there's more than enough. So we're wasting it. It's crazy wasteful. And Metro Transit, we're going to do something about it. So, you know, not bashing them all the time. So the idea, this is Jarrett Walker's idea. He posted this on his website, kind of almost as a favor to its modern buses, I think, kind of give us some momentum. So that was cool. And he came up with a network that, with six lines, hits all of the major destinations on the peninsula and almost all the population. You'd have some routes to fill it in that isn't, you know, the high-frequency stuff. Six lines. We got 55 bus routes right now. How much easier would it be to keep that in your head and transfer here, drive in from Bears Road, transfer here, and get to the hospital? And you could transfer easily because the bus is running every 10 minutes, so you only have a five-minute wait. It's not a big problem. I can deal with that. Instead of trying to sync up every single of those 55 buses, so maybe it gets there at a transfer point, and I run across, and if not, I miss it and wait a half an hour. So the frequency lets you have a connected network where you don't worry as much about transferring. When you transfer on a subway network, do you care? It's a train running 4 minutes, maybe. Doesn't matter. In Paris, they run every 90 seconds or something. It's just mind-boggling. But we're not Paris, so sadly. So finally, it's about more than buses, for sure. It's also about more than transit. What else is it about? We talked a little bit about city building. It's about getting people to the bus. You got to have people walking easily to the bus. If you have a really good street network, people can walk to the bus and get on at the stop. It doesn't matter how good your transit service is, what the vehicle is, how fast it runs. If people can't walk there or bike there or get there easily, you're just wasting it. The other thing that's really important to transit is having lots of amenities to get to, because you can't bring everybody to their destination right at their door, so you gotta have a lot of stuff around it to kind of drive ridership. So walk score is a really great tool. You type in your address, and it gives you an idea of how car dependent or how walkable your area is based on the amenities. People are using it on MLS listing, saying I have a walk score of 83. That tells you something. People value walking. Enough people, at least, that real estate agents and people renting apartments consider important. So what I did, I typed in some addresses and got a walk score for some important places in Halifax. So this is Innovation Drive out near the sadly defunct RIM building. And we're putting lots of stuff in there. There's a new school. There's a lot of kind of suburban business park type stuff. There's some apartment buildings. Lots of new growth going in there. Walk score, 27, car dependent. Not a good transit market. Also, lots of cul-de-sacs. So this is the new stuff we're building, and we're saying we want to be a transit city. It's not going to cut it. So let's kind of move up the ladder a little. Burnside, 20,000 people or so work in Burnside, more than downtown Halifax now. Spread over a huge area, and it's car dependent. Does that sound fair for Burnside? I've walked there. It's not very good. So a 45 out of 100 for Burnside. Oxford Street and Cork Street, pretty close to my house. A really lovely neighborhood that I absolutely love in the West End. They gave it a 68 out of 100, somewhat walkable. There's, you know, diners, there's a lot of stuff. I'd argue it's totally walkable, but we're getting better. This is kind of the edge of the dense band of housing on the peninsula, and you're still pretty walkable. So that's good. That's good for transit. And 5410 Spring Garden Road, right here, 98 out of 100, a walker's paradise. Does that sound right? As long as you don't have to cross the street. Yeah, absolutely. Walk score, just for, walk score doesn't take into account the pleasantness of your route. It doesn't take into account safety and amenities. So yeah, use some judgment with walk score, and they do say straight up on their website, they're like, this is amenities only, straight line distance. But it in general, I find it gives a pretty good idea. And it's partly because walkable amenities tend to go with nice street patterns. It's just people who value walkability go to the places that are good for walking. So walk score. So the final thought to leave you with this evening, and I talked to Mark, who's one of the founders, really, from the Planning and Design Center of It's More Than Buses, and he said about this slide, he said, you know, it should really be every trip begins and ends on foot or on bike. And I thought about that, and I do actually disagree, because even if you have a bike, you might take 4 steps. Every single vehicle, you got to get off and walk at some point. There's probably exceptions, but they're pretty rare. At some point, you have to be a pedestrian on some part of your trip. So if we want people walking, taking transit, building a great city, the absolute foundation is great walkability. You got to be able to cross Spring Garden Road. You got to be able to get to the bus stop. I'm done. Thank you very much. Fantastic crowd. Lots of people.
That was Lions by the Just Barrelies. You're tuned to Habitat on CKDU 88.1 FM, habitatradio.ca, and RPN, the Rabble Podcast Network. Thanks for listening. Last up today, we bring you the second installment of Talk Energy, produced by our friends at CHUO in Ottawa.
You're listening to Talk Energy, where we hear from Canadians across the country, talk with a variety of energy experts, and explore lessons from Canada's energy history. Our mission? To find out what it means to understand energy and why understanding energy is so important for Canadians. My name is Ophira Horowitz, and I want to know, are you ready to talk energy? Do you think the public knows enough about energy? Is it an important issue?
No, I don't think people know enough about energy. I think they know basics, example for the cost, but other than that, they don't know much.
The public doesn't know, and it is important.
What kind of things have you personally done to save on energy, and are you willing to make changes to your lifestyle or pay even more dollars to save energy?
I turn off the lights when I go to work.
I do not own a car. I do public transportation or biking or walking.
I would definitely be willing to change my lifestyle. We changed all of our light bulbs to energy efficient ones. Day-to-day things like unplugging appliances and that kind of stuff we do, but if someone were to inform me of some new ways, I would be willing to try them for sure.
If the entire world were to experience a blackout tomorrow, what do you think would happen?
Panic would ensue, I would believe. I think most people would not be prepared.
I think life would go on as normal.
We will stop and think, how can we make it better and try to be more respectful and, well, we will have to slow down. There's nothing else we can do.
You just heard views on energy from across Canada. Now let's turn to Mike Cleland, a veteran of the Energy Dialogue, for his take on the importance of energy literacy. Mr. Cleland has been involved in energy at many levels over the past four decades, working as the Assistant Deputy Minister in the Energy Department of Natural Resources Canada, serving as an executive of the Canadian Electricity Association and President and CEO of the Canadian Gas Association. He's currently the Nexen Executive in Residence for the Canada West Foundation. Mike, what does energy literacy mean to you?
Well, let me maybe divide this into two parts and maybe two different kinds of people. There's people whose business, you know, whose jobs are about influencing or determining energy choices, and that they could be in government or industry or other places. And then there are people who also want to inform those choices, people who are actively involved in thinking about energy. And I would say for those people, it is really important to understand how the energy system works, and the word system is important there. But there's a whole lot of other people, for most of whom energy just isn't a priority, and I think we should respect that. I don't think we should be saying that all Canadians have to be energy literate any more than you as a driver should be car literate in terms of understanding how your car works. But there are the people who want to shape the system really do need to understand it.
Why is it so important that Canadians learn about energy, although you've just touched on this a bit?
I think there are two main reasons. And I would start with the fact that we are one of the world's largest users of energy on a per capita basis or relative to the size of our economy. We may be third or fourth in the world in that regard. And one of the things that people worry a lot about is the environmental impact of energy. If we want to reduce the environmental impact of energy, we need to understand a lot more about our energy use. So I'd say that's the most important reason. But another one for Canadians that is extremely important is that energy is a very big part of the economy. And that's true right across the country. It's not just an Alberta thing. So we need to think about how energy choices of various sorts affect costs in the economy, how they affect jobs, how they affect incomes.
Mike, so you mentioned that not every Canadian needs to be energy literate in order for us to begin a dialogue about it. But what's one thing about energy that every Canadian should know?
Well, one way or another, I'd say probably just about every Canadian cares about the environmental impact of energy to one degree or another. Certainly anyone who wants to do anything about that needs to start by thinking about how we use energy, where we use it, how much we use it, and why we use it. Now, as I say, not lots of people have other things that they're thinking about. That isn't their priority. But if you really care about the environmental impact of energy, that's what you need to do.
Now, I hear people all the time saying they'd like to be more energy literate, but they don't know where to start. What do you think the biggest obstacles are for these people to energy literacy, and how can we overcome them?
Well, in one sense, this is a relatively easy one, and it is a fact that in Canada, it's not very easy to find readily available facts and analysis from trusted sources. This is something that governments should be investing in more by ensuring that we have that information. It's not a huge cost. It needs time to set up the right kinds of institutions, and it needs some money. But compared, for example, to the United States, which has very good energy information, or Australia, Canada lags far behind. This is something we could do something about quite easily.
Now, finally, Mike, you've been working around the energy conversation for a number of decades. How do you think the conversation has changed in Canada over time since you've started out?
I would say that people seem more aware of energy issues, and I get that in part by what I see in the media. There's a lot more media coverage of energy, let's say, in the last 10 years than 10 years before that, and it's pretty good. It covers a lot of the ground, and it's pretty solid. I think people are largely better informed about energy. I don't really have any evidence for that, but it feels that way. But that said, I think far too much energy thinking is still too heavily influenced by, I'll call it ideology, and I mean on both sides or all sides of the energy debate, by spin, you know, sometimes by governments, sometimes by companies, sometimes by environmental groups, and by what I'll call celebrity thinking and by myth. And as it turns out, even some so-called experts in the energy field are actually not all that knowledgeable, and there's some research on that. At least not all that knowledgeable about the whole system works. So I think we've got some work to do there.
Yeah, that's definitely food for thought. Mike, thank you very much for your time. You can't understand energy without understanding energy's past. Let's delve into Canada's energy history. We're speaking to Sharon Babian, the curator of transportation at the Canada Science and Technology Museums Corporation. We're going to talk about how understanding the history of nuclear energy helps people understand the making of current public policy. Sharon, over to you.
All policy, including nuclear energy policy, is complicated. And in order to understand it, it's really important to understand how and when and why it was made. So why we have nuclear reactors in Ontario has a lot to do with the history of the Second World War, industrial and technological development that grew out of the Second World War. To have a nuclear energy capability was considered very important. It was high technology, it was the way of the future, and it was going to be a way of opening up all kinds of doors for industrial and technological development in Canada. As a consequence, Canadian policymakers decided that we should develop a nuclear industry in Canada. At the same time, Ontario was interested in having a made in Ontario source of energy because at the time they were dependent on exterior sources. So nuclear energy became a made in Ontario solution to industrial development, which was going to require a lot of energy, and also to developing a very high-tech industrial field, that is the field of nuclear energy and development. So between the federal government and the provincial government, Ontario became a nuclear province and became highly dependent on nuclear energy. This is something that often doesn't enter into the discussions of the good and bad of nuclear energy. Now we're looking at it as something that's maybe not the best source of energy, and yet we need to understand why it came to be and why we have it and why it's so important in order to look at it now critically and say, do we still want to develop it? Do we want to phase it out? Do we want to develop it in a different way? Those are all decisions that young people in Ontario are going to have to make. And so it's important that they look at the history of the development of nuclear energy in order to make those decisions.
This program was brought to you by Let's Talk Energy, an initiative of the Canada Science and Technology Museums Corporation, in partnership with your local community radio station. This segment was co-produced by Let's Talk Energy and CHUO 89.1 FM. Thank you to CHUO in Ottawa, CJSR in Edmonton, and CKDU in Halifax for providing interviews with Canadians from across the country. Special thanks to host Afira Horwitz and sound editor Adriana White.
You've been listening to Habitat on CKDU 88.1 FM, habitatradio.ca, and rabble.ca/podcasts. Got feedback on the show? Call the CKDU feedback line at 494-8041 or email habitat@ckdu.ca. Or check us out on Twitter at Habitat Radio. I'm Erica Butler. Thanks for listening.